wish they'd hurry up with that transmission on one of those ramps. I suggest that you reach deep down inside yourself there and try and find something that'll keep you awake just a little while longer, because this transmission coming up may just rekindle your will to live.
About it, and I have no idea. I have no idea. I have no idea why I'm here. I don't know what I'm doing, you know, talking about this. I saw something, they saw something. There was a lot of light. That's all I know.
Invisible barrier. It keeps anyone from getting out. It's designed to keep me inside, but it keeps everyone else in too. I'm sorry.
Was the kind of world we'd made. 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 World we'd made.
The third premise: any dominating idea, plan, or purpose held in the mind through repetition of thought, any dominating idea, plan or purpose held in the mind through repetition of thought and emotionalized with a burning desire for its realization, is taken over by the subconscious section of the mind and acted upon through whatever natural and logical means that may be available. Now, in that paragraph, you've got a tremendous lesson in psychology. If you want the mind to pick up an idea and to form a habit so that the mind will automatically act upon that idea, you've got to tell the mind what you want over and over and over again. No end to it.
And you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. The name of the show,
we'll be right back.
and you are tuned to Listener Sponsored Radio. And I am actually joined by the inimitable Dr. Kelly Wright. Dr. Kelly Wright, how are you?
Good evening. I'm well. How are you?
You know, been better, been worse. That's my. I'm going to bring back that line. So we have quite a bit to talk about here today, and this music that I'm playing is probably a bit happier than the topic we're going to talk about.
But,
there is a lot going on, and I do want to acknowledge that today's date is a very specific date, and it's a date that I want to acknowledge. There's a lot of things happen on this day, and there's a site called... it's called, let's see, what is this site called? It's called This Day in Working History, or I'm sorry, Working Class History. And Working Class History is a site, and they have something called, just like a number of other sites do on this day. And there's a lot of things that happen on this day. Let's just say a litany of injustices. But the one in particular that I'm going to talk about to start the show, to kind of set things up, is one that most people hopefully are aware of, and that was on August 21st, 1831, there was a rebellion of enslaved Africans led by Nat Turner, and it began in Southampton County, Virginia. Do you know that place at all?
I do. It is not far from here.
It is not far from you. Okay, so a literate preacher and dedicated Christian, Turner allegedly had visions in which God encouraged him to take vengeance on the enslavers. A solar eclipse in the county was seen as a sign to take action. And on August 21st, Turner met with a few other enslaved people in the woods to plan a revolt, after which they took farming implements to use as weapons and headed out. They attacked farmhouses, killing white enslavers and their families, liberating enslaved people, and growing their rebel force. Over the next 2 days, around 70 rebels killed around 55 whites, until they were scattered by militia and some arrested. Turner himself managed to escape and hide before eventually surrendering on October 30th, not too far from now. Following the rebellion, Virginia lawmakers held a vote on the abolition of slavery, which almost passed, but the move failed by a few votes, and instead legislators decided to crack down further on enslaved people, prohibiting black people from learning to read or preaching. Now, that is a piece of sobering history, and I bring it up for several reasons. I bring it up because of the theme of tonight's show, and I'll just give you the theme, and then I want to hear everything you, Dr. Wright, have to say about Nat Turner and Virginia and language. But the theme is...
Everything.
Yes, I know you do. The theme is education, language, and cultural enslavement, and the subtitle is How the Loss of History and Language Shapes a Culture. So, talk to me, Dr. Wright. What were your thoughts when I decided to bring up Nat Turner today?
Well, I mean, hesitate to say that you're excited ever like, you know, filled with joy to discuss such events.
Well,
right?
I'm filled with joy to hear your perspective.
But I was glad that we were going to talk about this on this day, you know, so close to 200 years. If it feels, you know, that's still in living memory. We can, you know, there's a lot to say. There's a lot to say, especially about education, language, cultural enslavement. Even like what we know of this individual, is because of the state, because of like state records, right? His name being something, being, you know, related to his ownership and his confession, you know, being something that was taken like down while he was under state control. So it's interesting. We think about him and a handful of others as like the only enslaved people to revolt, but it's really just the only enslaved people whose names we have, whose stories are left to us, right?
Well, I don't want to interrupt you, but you're absolutely right. And as a matter of fact, yes, there were many slave revolts. That was only one. That revolt in itself was even inspired by some others, and others, many others were inspired by that. But many were struck down. It's just like we hear about one massacre of a black neighborhood. And there were many, far too many, far disturbingly too many. So, and you said something else specific too. You know, what do we know about Nat Turner? How do we construct what we know? And it's based on records, you know. And so that dovetails into a lot of what we want to talk about on the show. But what else? I know you had a few more things you wanted to say. So.
Well, I do. I mean, it's I guess far-reaching. There's this day, this topic, these events are very timely, you know. And I know I don't want to jump ahead too far, but I know, you know, we're going to talk about, or maybe we will talk about these AP tests and what it means.
Oh, we're talking about history. Yeah. We have to. This is
we're talking about it all. Yeah. And so it's something, it's like these events, you know, that we're discussing right now are the exact sorts of things that are actively being removed from history. And so like the idea that, like you saying at the top of this, like, I hope you know, or like most people will know, but it's like most people of a certain age perhaps will know. Most people who are born in like this, you know, boundary of years will know. That's maybe
those may be above the Mason Dixon line.
Right. I mean, there's like an interesting and important squishiness to these facts, you know, that comes from all these angles, right? Of that, you know, it was taken down, they're taken down by the state, and also like, and what that means for the present of, you know, the state being in control of facts.
Yes, that again dovetails into the title, because the state being controlled of facts is, someone once said, you know, history is written by those, you know, by the victors. So we are watching a continued victor, let's just say victor curated history. So, and it's being curated further. But go ahead, what were we going to say?
Well, I guess I just, this point, you know, of enslaved people like learning skills or having certain things, you know, at their that they've benefited in some way from generations of enslavement, and dispossession, right? Like that is exactly what's at play in these Nat Turner events, right? Like you aren't moved to stalk through the countryside and kill 55 people, you know, men, women, and children. You're not moved to do that in any situation in which you're thriving or finding fulfillment or can, like, you know, cast down your bucket where you are, right? Like none of that is happening. You know, no one is moved to do these types of things.
You mean pulling up those bootstraps? Sorry.
You know, I mean, pick your metaphor. You know, he begins enslaved work at age 12. His father escaped. Like, so to have like the man who, you know, the closest thing to a father figure, it's maybe not even the man who raised you, right? Like in your house, like being someone who actually left and left love, you know, and comfort in the only ways he knew it to get away. So that like tells you something. There's also this so much to say about the confession that was published, you know, less than a month after his death, and the commodification of such a story and the dissemination of such a story, and how those things were at odds because the white, literally the white power brokers, I mean, there's no other way to say it, right? Because they control all printed text. So it's this idea of, people are trying to make money off of that, off of the story, but they also don't want the story spread. So there's a 30-year gap between these events and the end of the Civil War. And that, the success of some like very particular things during the end of the Civil War depends on this information, like the speed at which this information spread through Black communities, how it was able to spread. So there's like something about like, the seeds of rebellion, you know, here, and what that actually means for a group of, you know, a million people who are dispossessed, entirely separated from each other, and don't have access to the written word. So there's something about like this oral network that can be demonstrated here.
Well, not just to me. I agree with you 1,000%, but I'll go further to say that coming to where we are right now, if you can see how having knowledge of people who, even in your own time, who are rising up, will inspire you to rise up, to take that knowledge, just to know where we came from, to know where we are today, could inspire you to do a lot more, to know how far we have to come, to know what we've been through. All those things that would inspire to remove history is to really remove, especially for children at the age where they're most formative. I mean, we all know what it is that they're doing, because I feel like they're playing the long game. You know, so let's set things up for the future. But again, I agree. If that's what could happen when we were enslaved, just knowledge of what recent history could do. All of this, again, says quite a bit to me. So I'm going to interrupt you, but I have to underscore what you were saying.
This is a conversation. I feel that, there's a recognition of how much power, you know, even like the actions of one person or one group can have here, where you really see folks like scrambling to get ahead of this information. And we've seen like attempts to control information throughout history that also like reflect, you know, like a recognition of its power. So, you know, there's this effort to go and like cover, you know, statues, like the genitals of statues with fig leaves, like all over the ancient world. It's like, okay, we still definitely know that these body parts exist, but there was like this attempt at censorship. You know, we see censorship all over the place and always have. There are, you know, certain levels where we agree, like things where we agree that it can be harmful, but that recognition that like some things, some ways of being, it's not entirely free, is like a recognition of how much power we have when like somebody fully embraces their freedom of expression, right?
Well, 100%. And even I'll go even beyond, I think, to embrace the freedom of expression, but just embrace having, you know, I think this also has a lot to do with identity. Like, who are you? You know, one of the things we'll talk about in the topics here is, without a knowledge of history, you know, there's a great, I didn't want to go too far ahead yet, but I'll read this part here because I thought this was really, one of the things I wanted to posit here, you know, one of the questions that I had written was, how does slavery affect culture? And it says here, in addition, slaves exerted a profound influence on all aspects of American culture. The American language, good thing we have a linguist here, is filled with Africanisms. Such words as bogus, bug, phony, yam, tote, gumbo, jamboree, jazz, and funky all have African roots. Our cuisine, too, is heavily influenced by African practices. Now, just to touch upon, we're just talking about the history of some words here. So tell me a couple things that I might learn from some words just to show the importance.
Well, looking at a language's vocabulary, any language's vocabulary shows you, you know, where it's been. I mean, essentially, you know, you can like, right, like you slice open a tree, you look at its rings, you know something about the years that it's experienced. So, you know, the Latin, the German, the French we are carrying around in our language has, you know, to do with moments in time for English-speaking people. Right, or English using people. So the Africanisms that are in our language are no different, right? Like we were in what they call intense and intimate contact with these languages or these ways of languaging. And what's interesting, I suppose, is the conditions, the enslavement, those conditions are somewhat artificial or deliberate and affect change in a somewhat different way than other language varieties that come in intense and intimate contact. So we look at like the ways in which industrialization affects language change, where there's lots of migration, right? Like whole groups of people move, like uproot and move to a city to work in factories because they can no longer work the land because the land isn't public anymore. They literally put up a no trespassing sign. Let's talk about language controlling society, right? This land that I used to graze on, that I used to forage fruits on, right? Like I can't do that anymore. I have to go work in the city. You know, enter Marx and Engels. All right, I'm sorry. The language of those like hamlets, that doesn't exist anymore. The way of life in those places doesn't exist anymore. So it can be seen as like comparatively genocidal, right? And when we're talking about culture.
Culturally genocidal.
Right. Like, so what happens to those languages in intense and intimate contact with English is like similar and different to what we see happening in enslavement, because that industrialization change, those people had a choice. The people who left the hamlet and went to work in the city, like their choice was I move or I starve, but they still chose, right? And it is different than being like uprooted from your community and having to, on the other end, be like, all right, none of us know each other's languages, but there's something that we share. We share enough to be able to create a way of life. And African American language starts right there. It starts, you know, 1690s, right? On the shores of this country. It is as old as this nation, right? And it starts building from whatever was common in the people who made it, in those who survived. And that has a lot to do with its success, because the human will is this, you know, this outlying factor that we see playing a role in language's development from the beginning. So these people wanted to live. And so their communication structure is preserved.
Well, you know, and all right, I'm going to go further, because we're talking.
Like, I'm like, without books, without masks, without groups, without my family, without anything that's recognizable, right? Like, I don't have to write it down.
Well, you know, there's also one of the things we've touched upon, I think, in other conversations, too, is when, you know, when you come from a town, like, I don't know how many times I'll know somebody and they'll say something to me like, didn't you say that as a kid? I'm like, no, not in my neighborhood. We never said anything like that, you know, because it's just local. It's just the culture of that space. So it says a lot about who you are, how you speak, and what you're able to, how you're able to articulate. So,
and like that differentiation, the things that makes like Black language special, like the in all these different cities and areas where folks are, like that's, it's like a luxury. It's a real, it really speaks to the that people have been able to like sit down and choose what they do with language long enough that it could be different, right? So it's fascinating and inspiring, at least to me, in this mist of bad topics this evening.
Well, I can't imagine why anything having to do with words would be fascinating to you. Okay, I'm going to continue with this is All-Star, part of our setup. And again, for those who are just tuning in, you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. This is Night Shift, and I am Mike Sargent. I'm here with Dr. Kelly Wright, who is a raciolinguist. And the topic, the theme of tonight's show is education, language, and cultural enslavement. and how the loss of history and language shapes a culture. And largely inspired by what we're dealing with now, and I say the loss of history because that is literally what is happening. And part of why I want to cover so much ground is I think you can't overemphasize the impact, I think, of what's happening right now and what's happening in our educational system and what's happening with ideologies that have a very clear and specific agenda for our culture. So, and here's what it says here. And it says here, without history, a society shares no common memory of where it has been, what its core values are, or what decisions in the past account for present circumstances. Without history, we cannot undertake any sensible inquiry into the political, social, or moral issues in society. I have to ask you, do you completely agree with that statement?
Let me ask you, how would you define history?
That's a good question. And we're gonna get deep into what that is, because I guess my understanding of history is verified events that happened in the past, events that can be verified in some way. You know, I as a journalist myself, I'm familiar with fact checking. So, you know, there's ways of, you know, verifying information. There are records, there's oral accounts, you know, and it's similar to what happens in a court, you know. How can you prove that this happened? So I tend to think of history as events that can be proven that happened and that have been recorded. Is that...
You're
a linguist, you tell me.
Well, okay, no, I know, I asked for a definition, but this is me. I have often said that I think you're saying like verifiable facts and events, but you think you have a personal history, yes? Like the things that you've experienced and like heard and felt and like that is that history? And if so, like how does it,
you know,
I guess, contribute?
I'm with you.
Yeah, to this like sum total. Cause okay, it is often said, right, that language is what separates us from the animals. But it is our history, right? Like our particular way of communicating may be unique to our species, right? But we are the only species that, you know, preserves the individual experiences of some of our number, right? The individual perspectives of some of our number to be like part of like what this is saying, like we can't to undertake any sensible inquiry with later, right? This is what gives us like dominion over the planet, is these established ways of communicating and understanding the world that extend beyond a human life, right? Like that is what our species is particularly evolved to do, is communicate our experiences to the generations that follow us, right? So I don't know what part of that counts as history and what part of that is biological. Like I don't know where the separation is, right? Because we've been doing that information transfer long before we were writing anything down, or before we were even carving things into stone, or maybe even before we were speaking, right? So this idea that this is maybe this information transfer is something that's uniquely human, and also we've been doing for a very long time, I think points to why control over that information transfer grants individuals such lasting power, and Absolutely. How early, maybe, and it's fascinating maybe how early on that ability to like get your way of thinking looped into the next generation
that's the whole point of
organized
that's indoctrination. that's the essence of what indoctrination is. I mean, you know, the narrative for, let's just say, many American children for many years was that Indians were savages and, you know, we were taming the Wild West. It was wild. We had to conquer it. It was wild. You know, it was wild. You know, that picture, Christopher Walken. It was wild. Right, so, and so I say that to say that, yes, positing certain narratives, and this is really what, again, as a storyteller, this is coming back to the power of narratives, because history is a narrative. And history, we have personal histories, and that narrative creates our identity. And so we have a cultural history, and that creates who we are. So to edit or deny, or it fundamentally changes who we are, or, you know, what we will, once again.
It does. And so to your point, let me come back to who we are, because questions that I'm asking in the work I'm doing right now really probe that and ask, like, who can we be? Who can we be based on what we have to make meaning with? Let's come back to that, right? Because it sounds like it's way out there, and it's not maybe as far out there as it sounds. This idea of, like, controlling a narrative, this period of time when Nat Turner is rebelling, right? And does so, there's an eclipse, there are other things, but there's also an event in his life that happens, like, right before, the rebellion. And it is that his son is placed as collateral against this long-standing debt. So the family had been having trouble to pay these debts. These people were coming, and they put up his child, right, to cover this debt that they knew they were not going to be able to cover. So, like, when the next time they came back, they were going to take this boy, right? And this is happening to his son. He's like, the only way for me to stop this is to, like, get a handful of people together and slaughter everyone in the valley. All right. This idea that you're property, you're not a person, that you're property. That is this thing that you can't get over without slaughtering everyone in the valley it's all happening at the same time that, like, science itself is solidifying, like, into a pursuit. And at the same time as we've all seen, or maybe people of a certain age have seen, the triangular trade map, right? The Columbian Exchange, where these trade routes are being laid not only across the globe, but across the ocean. Like, all this stuff is happening for the first time, and it's all being organized. And that has to be done with cooperation, right, among these colonial powers. And the first things that they agree on are units of measure and time zones. I every time I talk about this, it's like smoke starts to come out of my ears. You cannot know where or when you are without making an appeal to these frames of understanding, right? So this like Cartesian logic, like, all of this stuff, like, comes into how we measure and what time it is and where you are and how you can, like, make sense of the world. And then science comes along. There's this one writer that I love. His name is Nader. He calls it, like, early science of, like, laying the keystone of modernity. They walk around this newly gridded world where you can know where and when you are, and anyone else reading what you're writing can understand that in context. And they start labeling everything, right? I mean, and it is this idea of what is, like, primitive versus civilized, or simple versus complex. Like, they literally stalk the world, kill everyone who tries to stop them, and put labels on all of the places and the people and the stuff, right? I mean, that is happening at the exact time that this rebellion is ongoing. So the idea that none of that work had been done yet, that enslaved people, if they were able to wrest control, that they could have written a different future. You know, the idea that someone who has never seen a word and understood it, a written word and understood it, could understand that in their own heart, that they had enough power to reach for freedom in that way. Like, that to me is what, like, is the amazing moment
that's in my opinion, to in a situation like that, to even imagine being free is like, that's Afrofuturism. But let me say this. The other thing that I think is important about the context, you know, and the context is context. And I can't emphasize how important what you just said, knowing about, it's one thing to know, let's say there was a rebellion. Let's say, oh, there was a sign from God. That you know, slavery's bad and all that, so you get it. But then the more context you have, then the more and more you understand. And that simple equation, the more context you have, the more you understand, that opens up the door to so many things about understanding the past. And for, you know, black students and white students, for anybody who's going to learn about what really happened in this country, not knowing the context, that, let's just say, if you've changed the context, like, oh, you know, they were violent too, and they were getting benefits. We were just, you know, we weren't treating them well, but they were benefiting. We were giving them skills. It was a trade school. It was just a mean trade school. That's all slavery was, you know? So creating that kind of context, like removing all the context and creating that kind of narrative, that narrative without context, it's like anything. It's like you walk in the room and you're standing over the body with a knife and it's dripping. You don't know what happened 2 minutes before. So,
yeah, I mean,
just coming back to what you're saying.
These colonial powers, I mean, you're exactly right. Like, these colonial powers essentially, you know, they established normalized relations of human systems. So it's like...
Air quotes.
Normalized. Air quotes. You know, but no, but not even. I mean, not even. This is the thing. It's been 200 years. Like, the idea that we know where and when we are, all of these nations, like, start to control trade. They can then control, you know, they control communications. Like, every advancement in technology that every leap we've taken has been taken, like, within this framework. And so the idea of, like, controlling the framework or what it would take to reach outside it, or what it takes to reach outside it. That's, you know, anyway, I, when we're thinking maybe very specifically about enslaved people, one thing that's maybe interesting, or that looking at this group, are these moments where the control is so extreme, it like maybe highlights or like underscores some things that happen in regular language change that are just like really happening here, or like a lot easier to see. And that's, you know, right after the Nat Turner Rebellion, you said like the Virginia legislature, it almost passes that they get rid of slavery. As like an institution.
Almost, but instead,
and they don't consider it again until after, during Reconstruction. So when they like had to.
But almost, but they decided to go backwards. It's sort of like.
They go backwards.
Yeah, let's make abortion legal, but you know, in 50 years, yeah, let's go back. So.
Right.
Yes,
right.
But that's.
We changed our minds.
Yes, we changed our minds.
This idea that like, we. Enslaved people like already couldn't read or organize or do whatever, but now like they really, it's a serious crime to like even be in any like proximity of written material. And also they can't worship. So they can't, they can't gather for any reason.
Exactly.
That tells you these kinds of things happen. They happen at all different points of history where people are like removed from their access to knowledge, or it's like chosen. I mean, look, enter a whole conversation about American Victorian period. But like, something is still transferred. You know, it's still like, even without like, even this limitation of access, like this knowledge is still, it's still transferred. There's like still something that sets, you know, like these individuals apart, right? This community that came together, like I was telling you, like these survivors, like the will, there's like something that's there. There's something that, like I'm saying, like about our history that, you know, there's a biological component to it. When we look at like the way our species has evolved over time, we share our experiences like through the genome. There's like something that is like a threshold that takes into account what the entire all of humanity is experiencing at a given point in time. We don't really know what that mechanism is, right? Like epigenetics is like approaching, trying to just describe how we do this. But we do this, which means like it makes like something about our experiences like stays with us, even if we're entirely disconnected, even if we don't have a way of sharing knowledge, we're still sharing knowledge. We're still our experiences still count.
Well,
Well, like what all of humanity knows. And so this is like this thing about like cultural trauma, like it's our sum total of experiences. So we were able to see like markers of the Holocaust in the genome.
That's exactly what I was going to say. I was going to say it's even in, that's not even getting into the genome. That's not even talking about how things are passed down genetically. So
right.
I'm with
and
you.
And so like that, if that is happening, then it's also happening in every other way. You know what I mean?
That's my theory. Don't take my theory.
Well, I agree with you. Yes. I agree with you completely because how could it not be? Because how could it not be? 100%.
100%. You can't be the descendant of something. It's like being a descendant of an alcoholic. We could argue or nurture versus nature. But, you know, if that's been in your family, if your dad was a racist real estate guy, there's a good chance you're going to be.
And this is why, like, asserting things is important. Like, being able to, this is why, A, being able to say gay is important. And why B, people are trying to stop you from being able to do it, because it's important that you do, because it asserts ways of being and like shores up these futures, makes them real, right? And also why, and people don't want those futures to be real, so they're working very, very hard to make sure they don't happen. Buzzword and have those effects at the same time, you know?
Yes, and unfortunately, it's happening around the planet right now. So, all right. So, I do want to read a little something here. This is from UCLA. They have a public history initiative, and the title of this, it's a piece that's been written. It's called "The Significance of History for the Educated Citizen." And I'm only going to read a little bit of it because there are a few things in there that stood out to me and that I wanted to hear Dr. Kelly Wright's opinion on. And it starts out, it says here, and I'm just going to read this paragraph. It said, "Setting standards for history in schools requires a clear vision of the place and importance of history in the general education of all students. The widespread and growing support for more and better history in the schools beginning in the early grades of elementary education is one of the more encouraging signs of the decade." Sounds ironic. "The reasons are many, but none are more important to a democratic society than this." And this is the part that I wanted to emphasize. "Knowledge of history is the precondition of political intelligence." And I have to say, that's a pretty powerful statement, because it is. Without having any knowledge, and you know, politics is not just, you know, Republican, Democrat. You know, there is the politic of just being human. So, I want to know your thoughts on just that statement.
I mean, from what you read before, right, this a society that shares no common memory of where it has been, that is this thing that is, you know, like worth controlling, like incredibly worth controlling, like worth controlling that the concept of war was invented, is like controlling this common memory. So history, whatever the history is, whatever it looks like, is like this most important thing for function. You know, like the more that memory becomes, you know, uncommon or different, depending on like your perspective or where you are, the more dysfunction there is in your society. But, you know, like utopia, right? Like this idea of like a perfect society where nothing goes wrong, that is a society under total control.
That's the Federation, is.
Right. There is this idea that you living, no one lives in utopia because it's not really somewhere where life takes place. It's somewhere where all the rules are set up for a way of life in which none of the bad things that happen. You can't hit play in utopia, right? You never get to see it move. You just get to understand how it would function.
Well, not if you follow the prime directive.
See, it don't be working. The prime directive don't be working. They be getting in trouble every week.
This is true. This is true. All right. Well, you know, okay. Now we talked about history and the importance of history, and there are definitely a few more points I'd like to come back to. But since it is right now 10:52, and you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, we're going to take calls in a little bit. I'm going to play a little music. We're going to take a small break. But in the next segment, I'm going to talk about something I read, and I really want to hear your thoughts on it because you alluded to it earlier, and that is the limitations of history to the field of intelligence. So, this is the segment I want to read here, and this is from something called The Limitations of History to the Field of Intelligence, and I really want, you've never read this report, have you? Do you know anything about this? Okay, good. Okay, this is, I'm hitting you with this cold, right? Okay, wait, okay, now I can hear you. Talk to me again.
Hello.
Okay, there you are. All right. It says, history as a discipline is not only useful in the academic arena, but also in the field of intelligence. The study of history helps one discern what the story is instead of what the problem is. It helps determine the who, the what, the when, the where, the how, and the why of a narrative. Now, we've been talking about narratives. And it says, by studying history, intelligence agencies can learn from past mistakes and aim to improve their performance. But at the same time, these lessons are gathered from intelligence successes or failures. They do have restrictions. This paper, and this is all from this paper argues on three epistemological limitations to the use of history as a learning tool. You ready?
Yes, I am.
first.
Hit me with those epistemological.
These are the epistemological.
It's like about, it's about knowledge. Of or having to do with knowledge.
Yes. Epistemological.
Epistemological.
It sounds better with a certain accent. These are the three epistemological limitations.
I can hear your silk cravat.
Yes, I do. My cravat, you can hear it. Yeah. It says here, first, history can be interpreted in different ways. Second, history can be misunderstood. And third, history will always have gaps. It's an incomplete story. Despite these limitations, however, the study of history is a useful tool for intelligence historians. History can clarify events and offer guidance and guidelines for decisions to intelligence practitioners, which I like that. I'd like to put that on my business card. It serves as a way to uncover past intelligence practices and expands intelligence history as an academic discipline. It says history is limited. History is of limited use due to the variabilities of perceptions and the bias of the interpreter. Personal interpretations of history can be taken out of context. On the one hand, the study of history can be used as a way to measure an organization's strengths and weaknesses in a way that makes room for future progress. On the other hand, interpreters explain a small fragment of a given story. In other words, as Gaddis says, if he or she never perceives more than a tiny patch of the vast tapestry of events, this is the context conversation we were having earlier. It says, because history can be viewed as a construction of events, such a construction depends heavily on the person who is telling the story. History is composed of facts, but facts do not speak for themselves. The interpreter speaks for the facts. It is the reader and interpreter of history who ascribes the meaning in order to adopt these facts to the story he or she wants to tell. And then this is the fifth, and I guess these are the last 2 points. It says, from this perspective, history is inevitably biased. Historians can only do so much as interpreting events, as the past is something that only historians can only represent. The only way history can be employed reliably is if they can travel back in time and objectively witness the events. However, while users, interpreters of history cannot rerun history as a chemist can rerun an experiment, they can do so with their minds working as their laboratories. And this is the best part. That being said, the degree to which history can be implemented as an intelligence tool actually depends on how it is interpreted and whose history is chosen for analysis. So, Dr. Wright.
That's it. That's just, you know, a 10-minute block of text. No, I...
Yeah, so give me a 30-second response.
Great. I am wondering, do I respond as the historian, you know, or do I respond right from this other of how I apply text, right? Because I work in historical sociolinguistics, right? Which deals with all of these problems in this different ways, or maybe, yeah, exists in a space that tries to understand historical events or build out or reinterpret, you know, extant data sets in like a more equitable light or a more inclusive light. Is maybe better to say more inclusive, to get all the data that you can, and use all of that data in your analysis. But in the computational work, like day one in a computational linguistics class, we're going to talk about those three limitations until, you know, they're ready to pass out. Because I've been speaking for 45 minutes straight. We're going to talk about those limitations about how a data set, how the researchers, imprints a data set, and then like how is included in it affects its function in the future, right? And like why description is so important. You have to, when you build a corpus, you have to, or like these large language models that like ChatGPT and all these other like AI systems are learning from, these large language models, when you put them together, they come with like a user guide. You know, there's a description of the materials that have gone into them and et cetera. And essentially that tool is only as useful as that guide describes what is in there, that gives you a good idea of what's being used, you know, to build that out. But these like inherent biases, people think about that as like, again, like racism being something that's like got a big ugly head, you know, it's just like white, you know, like masks and people riding through the country in big trucks with flags all over them, right? Like this thing of like, it's really bad. It's really blatant. That it's not just that. It's like, it's what we've been talking about. Like this idea of like a controlled, description of like the normalized relations of human systems is built into text, which is what these materials, our history, our literal history, like the actual material reality of human history. These systems of control are built into that. And that material reality of human history is what AI is being trained on. So it's only as good as its gaps. It's only as good as its gaps, which is like what I, you know, hammer home to students is like, this data set, it's not just that it's all white, or maybe like that's, it's not about whiteness. Like you could have a really well-balanced data set that only has white people in it, but they need to be white people from like different times and places, different professions. You know, like you can have, it can be inclusive and still specific, right? Like balance can come in all these different ways, right? Like you think about balance, like it's not just that. There's a bunch of different things here. It's that like it hangs in a constellation of like all of its features. I'm like doing like this thing with my hands where I'm like, do we get it? It's like, it's so, but it's really complex actually. You know, when you sort of think about what representation looks like in these data sets and then like why it matters, like, okay, like this has a bunch of people of different races in it, but it's all only from the 20th century. You know, so if we just take those 100 years, there's like so many assumptions that come in with the first page.
Well, also, right? Well, again, coming back to, you know, if we've created narratives in reality, so if we're creating an artificial reality, an artificial intelligence, we're creating those same artificial biases. I mean, I cover this quite a bit, but I can say this on the air. There's a very common chat, or I shouldn't say, you know, it's an AI program that most people have heard of, and it's called DaVinci. It's an app you can get on your phone, and you could just say something and it'll give you an image. Okay? Mm-hmm. And so I said to it, high tech secret agent in space. It gave me a drawing of like this Asian woman with a space helmet and you know, space background behind her, and she's in a space suit and, you know, high tech. And then I said, high tech African American science, you know, secret agent. You would be shocked at what it showed me. I will text it to you. I'll text it to you. But I just say that to say that it could not, you know, like you see in those old 60s things, does not compute. It's like, yeah, it did not compute. What it gave, yeah, had nothing.
There's springs
to do.
And steam.
It did not compute. And so it's just interesting because I think, you know, there is inherent bias. There was a great film. Well, what's that? No, there was a great science.
Please.
There's a great science fiction film. I don't know if you ever saw it. And it's called, I'm trying to remember now. It had Oscar Isaac in it. And he plays, he created a artificial, I think my iPad died. He created an artificial person, an android. And the android ends up, let's just say, being very sociopathic and not very empathetic. And, you know, that's how he was. So this thing was just another version of him in many ways. He created his own demise from it, you know, like the Frankenstein kind of thing. And I think that, you know, we create in our own image and our own image of things. And I think that that is, I think that that's part of it is, you know, all the biases and things that we have. But I think it's also, I think it's human nature to do that. What do you think?
Well, yeah. And I mean, we try, right? It's, there's, you know, this nature nurture thing. There's certainly both. There's certainly both happening. So I think there's maybe a question to ask. I mean, again, when we're thinking about African American languages, like what they look like now and how they came to be, and these like generalized like ways of being that have been preserved because those languages continue to be used. It's a question of like what it maybe like means to be black or something like that in a certain time. So like as the, you know, like a mother has like a baby on her knee, right? Like this thing of what am I saying? What am I saying to my child and how am I saying it and what's important and why am I doing it? Like all of the answers to those, like you said, those WH questions, Joshua Fishman writing in 1968, like says, like this most important question of sociolinguistics is who uses which language with whom and when? Like what am I saying? Like, and why? Like what, like the answers to all those questions, like tell me like how a variety gets transferred and, you know, by extension, a culture gets transferred. So it's maybe it's when, We didn't really talk about education, and it's okay that we didn't, but there's this idea of like science, like classification of saying like certain, like all, like of looking at all of the world's systems and being like, these are simple systems and these are complex systems, or these are primitive systems, or these are matrilineal systems, right? And therefore they're like lesser. All of that classification like justifies like the inhumane treatment that we see happening with enslaved people. Like Nat Turner, like all of these people are condemned to death. Many of them are dismembered. Like that was legal. It was like written down in Virginia law as like punishments that could happen for these individuals. Right. But we see this inhumane treatment happen for many non-normative groups. Like we can look at like any disabled person or, you know, homosexual individuals, like all of this, you know, like plays out for these other groups. And we see like the echoes of it still in the ways that Black people view their own language use, like the language that comes out of their own bodies as being like aberrant, right? Or something that should be fixed instead of this like proud, rich, intense, like history of a preservation of culture. Like, of course that's there. Like, I'm not trying to say that isn't part of the Black experience, but this idea of just saying, of like not being able to see Black language as something that's like worthy of pride or something that actually has a history or something that is quote unquote real.
Legitimate.
Like this, like what is real, you know, your belief about what is real really shapes how you behave. Right. And so this question of like, how does bias work in these artificial systems? Like we're still asking like how it works in natural systems, but yeah, it's all connected.
Well, I do feel, and you said we didn't talk about education. Well, you know, we still have a good 45 minutes to go because I do want to talk about that.
I want to take questions.
I know we are going to take questions. I'm going to give out the phone number. But the only thing I did want to touch upon before we take questions was your thoughts on just the banning of AP African American Studies and what's happening in Arkansas where these teachers said they're going to do it anyway. They're going to teach us course ending. So I just wanted to know if you had any.
Well, I think this is like right in the middle of what we're talking about, right? Yes. Of the effort to ban this, of saying it's not something that's worth teaching. like going back to, and
to literally say that it's something that's not worth teaching, which says your history is of no value. Your perspective is of no value. The critical race theory, that's a perspective. It's of no value.
Right. And you too, like say, like you're, and this is not a knock on you, but like your definition of history as verified events. Like this is saying that like these perspectives, these things are not critical race theory. Like those are not verified events. Like those are not things that actually, or they get, it gets rejected from the list of verified events of things that are like worth teaching. You know, that go into like you said, like a court, like the official
record. That calls into question the verification process though.
Exactly. Like that's the thing, is like, it's saying like, who is verifying it? So like right now we're seeing this happen in real time. Whereas like you and I have been talking conceptually about this, of like the winners writing history or whatever. I mean, that's essentially what's being attempted. Right. And I know that on a previous episode, we discussed, you know, like the, like Rosa Parks, like blackness being removed from the narratives about her, like this idea that like race isn't important. Like we can talk about what these people did, but we don't have to talk about their race. Or we can look at like these institutions and say like, okay, a handful of things came out of that. Like we can look at like anyone who survives trauma and it's like, okay, so like maybe rape victims, like as a group, have a higher pain tolerance, but like, let's not say that that's really like a net pause, you know, like what are you like, for me, like get out of my face with trying to say that this stuff isn't real. But then, you know, the researcher in me knows that these efforts are very successful, and they're successful incredibly quickly. There are plenty of things we don't talk about in school because maybe it's not necessary to, but you know, I mean, it comes back to this point. What you read earlier is like, without history, a society shares no common memory of where it's been, what its core values are, what decisions of the past account for present circumstances. I think that that's what's up for debate right now, is this timeline of how we got here. And what's on display is how flexible that is, right? That it's not that people think they can, they know they can. These people who are trying to reach into that timeline of events that got us to where we are very aware that it works. It works if you beat it hard enough.
This is true. All right. People are already calling. Hello, you're on the air. I haven't even given out the number. Hello, who's this? Hello? Hello?
Hi, Mike. How are you? Hi, doctor. How are you?
Hi, who's this?
Hello.
Hi, this is Gregory.
Oh, shocker, Gregory. So
you're very low on my end for some reason. I don't know why.
You can't hear me well. Can you hear me now? Is this better?
Yeah, much better.
Okay.
You know, doctor, Mike, again, of course, I love your program. I call in every now and then when I can. Doctor, I cringe every time I hear the, lack of better term, the appellation black language. Let me ask you a question. What is the alternate to black language?
Well, you've asked this before. I use the term African American languages, which is it's an umbrella term. It covers like languages of the Caribbean, as well as African America, which, as Mike and I were talking about, there are many varieties, right? Like the way you speak in Jacksonville is not the same as the way you speak in DC or Atlanta. I use the term black for myself and these languages because that's where I fall. That's how I describe my own identity. So I refer to black language, African American languages, with like an umbrella term that covers these like 400 years of experience of populations in a diaspora, right? That shares an identity group. So there's not really an opposite because they, you know, This is an individual community. It's distinct because of these experiences.
Well, so what's the nexus cogency of this language? Is it 400 years? Does it center around slavery or enslavement? Is that why it is, lack of a better term, branded as that?
I Yes, in some ways, because these communities, what makes African-Americans, you know, what unites them is this experience of being transported, you know, away from Africa, having their culture, you know, forcibly and in an organized manner severed, right? Like there is a way of taking somebody away from their home. And they're like, you know, isolating them so that they could not communicate, giving them new ways of being, like introducing them to Christianity and et cetera, et cetera. So what we're looking at as African-American languages, which again, you know, cover many, have to do with, you know, the languages of the colonized world that they came into contact with, how these groups, you know, solidified and were able to communicate with each other. So in many ways, African-American languages, one thing that unites them is resistance. So what we're talking about this evening of, you know, after all of this purposeful removal, these groups were able to come together, use what they shared to form ways of talking, things that go to the, you know, the tradition of playing the dozens, stuff that was seen as play or worship, which was actually, you know, communication, ways in which these rebellions were, you know, fomented. Those are the seeds of African-American language today. That's what's shared.
I see. So if I were to expand upon your definition, then it is a prohibitive language that is not innate to us, because I'm Jamaican myself, and not innate to us. And so it was thrust upon us, or it became an imposition where it's limited in so many ways. Does it have the ability or the capacity for expansiveness to include even greater capabilities as opposed to it being, lack of a better term, corralled by the experiences of 400 years and it being prohibitive because it lacks so much of our ancestral and cultural nuances? Is that proper description if I were to expand upon it?
I mean, I don't know that I agree with you. I don't know if Mike would agree with you either.
I definitely don't agree with you. I, as a matter of fact, I think the thing that is, in my opinion, okay, just to expand on what Dr. Wright said in terms of, you know, black language, you know, I think if we're just talking about America, you know, I would dare say black communities in almost every country have a way of talking that is part of that community. You know, you go to blacks in Philly, you go blacks in Chicago, you go blacks in L.A., you go to blacks in Brooklyn, you know, those black communities, they don't all sound the same. They don't all have the same slang. They may have some shared slang, but they have different colloquialisms. They have different ways of speaking. They have different phraseology. But it's all unique to where they are. And sure, you could say it still stems from. So to me, the fact that of any language or any aspect of what is considered, exactly, America, I'd say black language has evolved. Not only does it evolve the most, but I think it's been the most influential. You know, I was looking at some thing on TikTok, and they have like an Asian girl is trying to be taught English, and she's speaking in proper English, and this guy's like, no, and he takes and teaches her how to speak in, I guess, what you'd call black language. And that's American. That's in this Asian TikTok, in this other language, this is how they're teaching this young person. And that's played for laughs, but that's almost a truism, because that's how influential a lot of the phraseology that comes from what I would call black, a language, black, whatever.
So then black language is black
language.
Wait,
before I hear from you, Gregory, I just want to know if Professor Wright agrees with me.
I'm with you, Mike. It goes back to like the simple versus complex. Like, there's nothing, from my perspective, there's nothing different from African-American languages, black language, Ebonics, Ave, you know, whatever you want to call it. There's nothing different fundamentally, structurally, functionally, you know, different than there is from like German or Mandarin Chinese or anything else with like a capital L language that you would think you could like go take a class and learn. There's not, the only thing that makes that different is it's you know, foundational institutional representation, usage, understanding. This, when we go again, like going back to science as saying like what is simple and what is complex, the foundations of my discipline are people walking around in the American West saying, you know, these people don't have, these indigenous people don't have a future tense in their language that is recognizable to us white folks. And so we say that all indigenous people just don't have any concept of the future. That, okay, so this is what I'm saying is like the idea that Black language is less than African American language is something that can't be used or shouldn't be used or isn't structurally able to be used in domains of life. This is persistent from all of these ways that Black individuals were treated, like inhumanely treated, and Black people feeling that way about their own language is exactly what I work on. So I don't like agree with you as like a person or a researcher that these languages are less than. It's just how they're perceived. Now, maybe there's not a functional difference there. But like the point that I'm hammering home about like this isn't quote unquote real. I'm not somebody who gets to decide what the verified events are. Right? So I don't actually have control over reality. My reality is
no more important
than yours.
Wait, hold on.
Let me respond.
Wait, no, so, I'm trying to understand that she doesn't have control over reality all this time. That's why you're on the show. All right, go ahead, Gregory. I'm sorry.
Okay, Dr. Mike, I didn't purport to say or presume that the language is limited. But you describe it as experiential. And if it's within those constraints, then it is purely limited to, as you say, the 400 years of the diasporal, like a better term, gauntlet of mistreatment, slavery, so forth, so forth. So how expansive is it if it only pulls upon experiential?
Yeah, but expansive as compared to what, though? I mean,
you know, what's the difference when, you know, like in 1066, you know, like what happens to English, you know, William the Conqueror, you know, like this is the thing is like, that's experiential. That's what makes English look like it looks now. And as like a recognizable language that, you know, is somewhat romantic and somewhat Germanic. Yeah, and is that not experiential? You could ask that question about any language on the planet, right?
Right. And
what is it defined as white language? So that's why I asked in the beginning.
That's
a whole other kind of question, though, isn't it?
No, but I mean, this idea of like what makes Black language Black, like what makes Black language Black is this moment in time. What makes English a white language is, you know, it points to a different moment in time when whiteness became something that was like the possession of a standard speaker. That happens right when Webster writes his dictionary. American English becomes a standardized version of American English becomes distinctly white when Noah Webster begins to write an American English dictionary that is distinctly not British.
Okay, so then language is then categorized by the construct of color or race.
Maybe answer this question this way. When you hear a voice, when you hear someone's voice that belongs to a person you've never met, you call the DMV or order a pizza, you assign that voice any number of characteristics. You give that speaker an age and a race and a weight. You can find out, you can tell how far or close they are from the microphone, right? But Mike Scoot, you said you couldn't hear him. He scoots up, he's close to the microphone, he's louder. That, you take a ton of information in about a voice. When you don't know, and that's the thing is like, you're asking like, is whiteness important? Like, do you assign race to a speaker? Then it's important. And maybe it's not as important to you as it is to other listeners, but it certainly matters, right? It's part of how we use language. It's transmissible information.
Understood. So you describe the nuances of voice, so forth, tone, diction, so forth. But are the words themselves color coded? Is the word man from my tongue, Jamaican accent imbued with, is it white or Black? Are the words themselves?
That's a great question, right? I mean, I think part of the answer to that is how much does that matter to you, and how much does that matter to others, and how much are, you know, is that imbalance, right? Like this, I mean, these words that we listed, like gumbo, jamboree, jazz. Is jazz a white or a black word? And does it matter? Like, these things change. So we can make a decision right now on this, you know, show of whether jazz is a white or black word. But our perspective is only good for the present. It's only good for this conversation, for us, for the, right? Like, so, and if we make that decision, like, maybe it doesn't matter, right? Like, maybe it does nothing for how the word is used. So that's the question of, like, when we write down, like, who a word belongs to and where it comes from, like, I work for a dictionary, like, so I really actually take this question really seriously of, you know, whose word is this and where does it come from and how much does that matter? Like, how lasting is the answer even? So some things really matter. That sometimes the answer to that is it, you know, like the N-word or any other racial slur. Like, these words persist. They persist for reasons because so many people say, yes, the answer to this word matters. I mean, you can look at, again, like women's language, like all, you know, through all time and not even think about nationality. You can think about disabled people through all time and not even think about nationality. Like, there's reasons why these identities, like, quote unquote, matter, like, are lasting, have lasting importance. And it's all the same topic of, like, memory and history and what it means to just, like, transfer knowledge.
Okay. Well, Gregory, I do want to take a couple calls. I appreciate all your questions, of course, as per usual. I haven't even given out the number, though, and people are calling. I will give out the number for people who do want to call, and I do have a couple other questions for you myself, Dr. Wright. The phone number here is 212-209-2877. Hopefully, if the numbers work.
I will rant less. I don't. It's not a rant. It's enthusiasm. It's no, excitement.
It's not, I don't consider it
it's rant. Not aggression, I swear. No,
but, I mean, I feel like if I let you and Gregory go, like, you could, guys could be on there for, like, 3-4 hours. 212-209-2877. And we are talking about, well, we're talking about quite a lot of things, but we are talking about the topic and the theme of the show is specifically education, language, and cultural enslavement, how the loss of history and language shapes a culture.
It's such a, anyway, I love this question of, is it experiential? I'm going to stop, but that is so important to me, this thing of, like, what makes Black language Black? What is universal about this? Is there even, you know, value in asking questions about linguistic universals, which, again, like, goes back to the founding of my discipline, like Chomsky, like Noam Chomsky is out there talking about universal grammar, like trying to figure out what all language users know. It's like me asking, like,
well, that kind of brings
what, up. Where is, like, race is clearly a thing. So how does the thingness of that get transferred? And, like, what matters? I mean, what makes Black language Black, like, really is, like,
well,
something,
but here's the
that
question.
I want to tease apart because I'm not specifically interested in race, right? It just happens, these things happen to be really visible here for some reason.
Well, that to me, everything you're saying and everything Gregory's asking you dovetails into the other thing I want to talk about here, and that is language as a colonial tool, and what I've labeled here is the coloniality of language. And in my opinion, you know, we're discussing or debating what it makes, you know, Black language, Black American speak, Black English, like I said, all right, our derivative of English that specifically makes it Black. Okay, we could define that, like you said, but then the question is, who judges it? And what status, you were saying, you know, the legitimacy of it, the validity of it is determined by who and what. So I just like to know your thoughts on the coloniality of language.
Well, and yeah, and thank you. And thank you for bringing it back here. So, cause we can maybe think, like, language is a tool of colonialism, like maybe like the tool. it's up there. But this is maybe somewhere to think about, like, education, like its role, like, especially like in the American context, because we've always used the like acquisition or like a particular group's like fluidity or ability to like command standard English, like whatever mainstream US English looked like at the time, as a tool of like our imperial wing, you know. So looking at the ways in which, you know, like Chinese Americans, people from the Caribbean, right? Like looking at like how Haitians and people from the Dominican Republic are treated differently in this country. Like this, it has, there are intersections here with essentially everything, like that they all line up in the classroom. So so-called foreign language speakers, which again is a question of distinction, right? Like what is a foreign language? Because languages like German and French and Mandarin Chinese and English, you know, and indigenous languages and Spanish have like all been on this continent for like same-ish amounts of time. So like there really is this idea of like what is foreign. But so-called like foreign languages have, you know, like federally mandated like support in our education system. You know, if there's a certain percentage of people who speak this language within a school district, then the school district like has to provide English language learning education. Like people, they have to say like, all right, you have to be able to speak English to exist in our society. And, you know, there's like a burden on the state to teach the English language itself, but only with like certain amounts of population and only for people who speak like so-called foreign languages. So something like American Sign Language, you know, that deaf people speak, right? Like, is that a foreign language? Well, no, because it's American Sign Language. So there's not like the same burden on the state to teach, to have deaf education, right? To like support it. So there's like a real question of what, of like how, like who you are influences the ways in which you can like move through the state system of education, like how you become like a functional citizen, you know, like how you're socialized and how everyone else around you is socialized, like in relation to how you produce language.
Well, and then there's sort of the hierarchy of that of where language puts you in the social order. Now there, the phones are lighting up.
Yeah. And looking at the short version of that, like 2 seconds, is, you know, thinking about colonialism, right? Like you can look at how that has evolved over time through the education system. Pick any language I mentioned, pick German, pick Mandarin Chinese, American Sign Language. You can look at how they move through the education system and legal system differently and understand our nation's like imperial relationship with that country. So like looking at how Chinese was accepted or not accepted in any school system in the entire country will tell you what that, our relations with China, and like locally, globally, you know, you can look at it at any level, just throw a dart at the map.
All right. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, Michael. How are you doing?
Is this Bertolt?
Yes, that's me. You guys are talking too much and not letting them listen to us call in. What's up?
Well, I didn't want to cut her off. So what do you talk about, Bertolt? We got like 6 people calling right now.
Yeah, listen, I'm going to be very quick. You know, the previous caller, or 2 callers before, you guys were sugarcoating it. I've never seen such a racist and ethnocentric approach to language. You know, and then you guys were being nice to that person. I know that's a white or black person. But they are very backwards in this day and age. That approach is really backwards. And I'm from Haiti. We have a language called Creole, right? We have a religion called Voodoo. We have a civilization. We have a culture. We have, you know, we have art, and we have a civilization, just like the Greeks, the Romans. It's just that, you know, because we are conquering millions of people, no one even thinks about it. But the language has evolved the same way the French language has evolved. The French language is a mixture of the Languedoc and the Languedoc and a whole bunch of other things. And then a few people like Ronsard and a bunch of people came out and said, let's put this together and start structuring it and explaining what we're doing. That's it. That's language. I mean, that's why it's more formal or not more formal or anything like that. So I think that that caller was very ethnocentric at best and racist at worst. And I let everybody else talk. I you don't have to comment because you don't have to be a host.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you, Bertolt. All right.
No, but thank you. I have nothing to add. No notes.
No notes. All right. Hello, you're on the air. Hello. Okay. Hello, you're on the air. Okay. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello. Can you hear me? Okay. Who's this?
Oh, wait. Let me turn this up. Yeah, I can hear you now.
All right. So who's this? What's your name?
This is Antonio from Riverdale.
Antonio, so did you have a question or a thought or a comment?
Well, I was listening while I was doing things in the kitchen, and there was a little bit of a feeling of confusion. Thought of the phrase, what do you want, comes to mind. And also what came to mind was, eventually they got to color. I don't think we could intellectually get out of this using intellect. Einstein, you know, said a phrase that just goes across everything pretty much, and you can't solve a problem or a happening if you do the same thing or have the same situation at play. It's almost like taking the same chemicals, putting them together and expecting a different result. I was listening to an indigenous woman, well, that I'll use that word, a native or one of the Earth's peoples. I want to try to use something different. And she goes on talking on Amy Goodman's show, and she goes and she uses this word indigenous. And I said, that's it. She's lost. Because she learned that in school, in college, by the same intelligence that caused this problem as we go along here anyway. So what I noticed with the people of different backgrounds, I'll try to refrain from using the color words, they almost want to fight their way back in, or fight their way into the same misery. It's almost like we're not being, like, want to use intelligence to get in there, but it's not a good place to be because it's not helping this whole situation. It takes different, it's a whole different plane to solve this. Being a longtime BAI listener, your consciousness has to be in a different place. You, and at the core, you just say, like, well, you don't do anything to anyone unless, you know, that, you know, that's not nice, that you don't want to do to yourself. So the consciousness has to shift, and it has nothing to do with intelligence. And the minute that she used that word indigenous and three or four different buzzwords of like 11-letter vocabulary, she's lost. And I'm listening, and if you're more aware, like I guess I am, it's just the same-o, and it's almost like the new boss wants to take over from the old boss because the consciousness hasn't changed. You know, I'm pretty sure the Moors killed a lot of people along the way. You know what I mean? So it's a human thing, and it goes back even further than that. So thank you for allowing me to share. Oh, and just a little bit lighthearted stuff. I'm just kidding, but how come Mike Sargent and Harry Allen are never on at the same time? It's almost like Clark Kent and Superman. I think you're the same person.
I've heard this before.
You're one of my favorites. You've heard that before? All
I've
right,
heard
Mike.
That before. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'll listen if you have any response.
All right. Thank you. All right. We have a bunch more calls. Did you have a response specifically to what he asked?
Well, I think that, so what's interesting here is like this idea of like something that is like persisting. So like the things can't change, like intelligence maybe is one thing, but this idea of like how, like what, like how do you change it? Or how do you break out of this cycle? The idea that you have to like become a culture maker by whatever means are there to then like, you know, make your future true. There's truth to this, and we see that happening. There's like a linguistic process called accretion, which is what happens around a black hole. Very science fiction. We can look at terms like for mental illness, like throughout our, you know, lexicon, you know, there is a phrase called the R word right now that did not exist when I was younger, because what that stands in for, you know, was commonly used in regular speech. And before it was commonly used in regular speech, it was like a medical distinction, and a distinction that was different from like imbecile, or idiot, right? Like those words that we use all the time now used to mean something like very specific for people who were mentally ill, or had like other sorts of like deformities, like were disabled in other ways. And so we can look at, like, there are lots of different words that have started, you know, in, or have stood in for these concepts, these groups over time. But the way we treat the mentally ill, the disabled, people who we feel should or should not be institutionalized, like throughout our entire history as a species, like before or after industrialization, that really, it hasn't changed. The way we feel about those groups really hasn't changed. And so every effort that's been made to recategorize or re-describe these groups of people really hasn't done much for their individual experiences of daily life. And I mean, and we know this, like you can look at how like blind people are described in the Bible, like this stuff like goes, you know, back and back and back. So the idea that, you know, until certain things shift, it really doesn't matter like what language you're using or how you're codified or like how, you know, high you rise in society, until like certain ways of thinking shift, there are ways of being that just aren't reachable. And so that, like, again, to me, like speaks to like the power of and the limitations of like individual linguistic freedom, et cetera.
Well, the only thing I would say, I mean, I agree with you, and I more or less agree with the caller too, in that, you know, we've evolved technologically, but I would not say that we're an advanced civilization. You know, we have knowledge, but we haven't retained wisdom. And we don't live, even though we know how to live better, we don't. And I think the you know, from that science fiction point of view, you know, looking at the humans, I feel that's the great flaw, that, you know, it's within our grasp. You know, these concepts are not alien. They're not new. They're not new age. But they come to the core of something else, other constructs we've created that, you know, tap into, let's just say, the less enlightened part of ourselves. But let's see if we can get a few more calls before we have to go. Hello, you're on the air. Hello? Hello? I'm going to give out the phone number again. 212-209-2877. A lot of people were calling. Hello, you're on the air. Hello? See, that's what happens. What happens is while we're talking, like, we lose all the people. They get cut off. We'll try one more time, 212-209-2877. But you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI. The name of the show is Night Shift, and we are here Mondays, 10 p.m. to midnight, every week. Hello, you're on the air. Hello. Okay, that was nice and interesting. As soon as I cut off the music, they left. But the last question I wanted to ask you, I had the last two questions I wanted to ask you. While we see if there are any more calls, what would you describe? What is linguistic racism?
Yeah. Okay. That's maybe points us in some directions. Part of what we've talked about here of this idea that, like, Nat Turner's son was being placed up as collateral for a debt, right? Linguistic racism is at play in the laws that were written to make it official that these people were no longer people, that they were property. That's racism played out in linguistic distinctions, in the law, in the way people were treated, in how you could speak to others, right? Like, all of this, like, has linguistic consequences. My work on linguistic racism looks at this from a couple different perspectives. So how language is used to describe Black people, and then also how the language Black people produce is perceived. So just because, like, the color of your skin and the way you move through space, like, how that influences how you are heard. So that's where I look at linguistic racism, is like how Blackness is written about and then how it's heard or perceived. So everything that we've talked about here is, like, relevant to how an individual Black person, like, moves through the world, how they understand themselves, like, their own Blackness, like, how they understand it, like, has to do with, like, how it's been described in the past, and how their community views it, right? And then, like, how other people view them, like, how much Blackness they choose to show to the world and or are able to show, and how it's perceived.
Okay, now, here, considering everything we've talked about tonight, do you think there are any effects linguistic racism has on people that we don't see with other forms of racism? As there are many forms.
Yeah, this is a great question. So what makes linguistic racism special?
And let me preface it to say, because I think part of what you were saying about what linguistic racism is just that it's taking ideology and codifying it and putting it down. It's really legitimizing it on another level so that it can be easily handed down. This information can easily be transferred. So I feel like those are some of the things I feel that's part of the power of linguistic racism. So I just want to know.
You're exactly right. So, like, when, you know, people look at it, is, again, like, this difference between, like, racists and racism. Like, racism is, like, it's like an ideology. It's part of the sea we swim in. You know, so this question of, you know, like, does a fish know it's wet? Like, a fish spends all of its life in the ocean. Like, does it have a concept of wetness? Like, that is, like, this idea of, like, racism. Racism is, like, part of the sea we swim in. Like, we're absolutely slick with it. So, like, how, like, I may not be a racist, or maybe I am, but that's, like, defined by my actions and my behaviors. Like, racism is just, like, part of our moment. The same thing with, like, you know, any ism, all the isms, right? And so, like, what you do or do not participate in with your behaviors has a lot to do with your moment. You know, like, on here, we've talked about, like, language and space time, you know, and how, like, what we're able to produce is controlled by, you know, the speed of a sound wave through air. You know, that we can think about those constraints in the same way of, like, everything that's not defined by the physical laws of the universe, right? That, like, actually, like, what our mouths and hands are capable of communicating, like, based on the speeds of sound and light. Like, everything else has to do with society, like, what lays on top of those, you know, innate physical constraints and abilities. So, yeah, right, okay. It's like the isms of it all, right, are dependent on, like, what we know and what we do.
That's a good name. That's a good name for a book. Maybe we could take one last call. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello. Hello, are they still taking a call?
Yes, this is you're the last caller.
I can't hear you.
You're the last caller.
Oh, I'm the last
Yes, you need to turn down your radio.
This woman, what is her background? Is she an author of some book she's trying to sell? What is she talking about?
She is a raciolinguist, ma'am.
Hello?
She,
yes. We turned the radio off.
Yeah, that would help. That would help.
Yeah, can I just, about 20 or 30 minutes listening to this program, I can hardly understand her very language skills. Is she an author or some guest on the show for some reason?
Yes, she is a raciolinguist, and her, she's...
Go ahead. Let me turn my speaker. Go ahead now.
I said she is a raciolinguist.
Hello?
Okay. Ma'am?
Hello?
Yes. Wow. That was something. Okay. Hello, you're on the air. All right. Well, that was our last call of the night, so there it is. She couldn't understand your language skills there. Just so you know.
You know, I've heard that. I've heard that. Yeah. I know I talk fast.
Yeah. Ooh, there it is. Well, you are tuned to listener-sponsored radio, WBAI, 99.5 FM, and this is Night Shift, and it is time for us to go, and we will be here next week. You'll be back, what, on the 18th?
Back on the 18th.
Back on the 18th.
That's right. I'm not here selling anything. Unfortunately, you're stuck with me.
I'm
a co-host.
She's just a co-host. Just a co-host. All right. Until next week. And if you've enjoyed the show, please consider making a pledge. You can call 212-209-2950. Or you can go online to give to WBAI.org. Thank you, Kim.
Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you, Mike.